Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast that's more bracing than a slap in the face. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Good morning.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We're going to get into some smack talk about U.S. foreign policy. I'm sorry.
You're not sorry at all.
Man, this podcast already slaps.
No.
There you go. But first, are you tired of feeling like someone's always watching you on the internet, even when you use so-called incognito mode? Well, IPVanish VPN is here to protect your right to privacy and help you stay anonymous online. IPVanish enables you to browse safely without exposing your private bits to third parties, whether they be advertisers, ISPs, hackers, rooskies. When you use IPVanish on your computer, tablet, phone, or even Fire Stick, all of your data is encrypted. That means all your private details, passwords, communications, browsing history, physical location will be completely shielded and without sacrificing your speed. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. It really is that simple. IPVanish is offering an incredible 70% off their yearly plan for Reason Roundtable listeners. That means most of you, all with a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's like getting 9 months, an entire pregnancy for free. Just go to ipvanish.com/roundtable and use the promotional code roundtable and take your privacy back right the heck now. That's ipvanish.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, I know we're supposed to talk about serious stuff, but I got to know this.
Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick.
Where am I? I'm having an Admiral Stockdale moment. I feel like I was just slapped.
Turn your hearing aids on, baby.
Yeah.
Did anybody else's household this morning contain or house or do something surprising divergences of opinion about Will Smith slapping Chris Rock in the face on last night's Oscars? Catherine, do you want Dan to slap Sorab Amari?
Careful.
In the face?
My household did not discuss the Oscar slap this morning because my husband lives a good and virtuous life that is not extremely online, and so he probably still doesn't know. And I didn't watch the Oscars, but did enjoy the Twitter commentary that followed, which included to me like a really glorious horseshoe theory moment in which people who are like hyper woke disability awareness vigilantes and also conservative like chivalry fetishists were like, he did the right thing. That like that convergence, I was like, I want to get off of this horseshoe ride, and I never will.
The horseshoe ride just sent me down a pretty dark path there, Nick. Suderman, what was the McSuderman household? What do the very large dogs say?
I mean, they're always up for some fun.
Physical altercations.
They were just. Yeah, I mean, they don't really understand like what that is, because like I'm constant, like the big one is constantly pawing me in the face as it is.
So you reenacted it in your house this morning.
He was just, I mean, like that's his mode of communication with me. It's just like a paw in my eye. I got a giant scratch on my face for a week last week. No, I mean, there's not really, I don't really feel like there's actually two sides to this. Unprovoked violence is not acceptable. It's not acceptable for insults. It's not acceptable for jokes. It doesn't matter if the joke was offensive. It doesn't matter if the joke was mean-spirited. It doesn't matter if it was a series of incredibly rude and inappropriate jokes about someone's physical appearance. Violence in response is not okay. And I would probably have been on Will Smith's side if he had kept it to a kind of heckling, like a verbal response, even like a loud and you know, sort of disruptive one. But like, you can't make the choice to stand up and walk across a stage and slap somebody And Will Smith did. I mean, he literally did the like we joke on Twitter every morning about, oh, this person, like they posted a tweet that's going to get a response and that person chose violence.
Chose violence.
No,
yeah.
Will Smith literally chose violence in front of thousands of people in a live audience or 1,000 or so and millions of people watching on television. And it's not okay. It doesn't mean he should go to jail, to be clear. It doesn't mean that he should end up, you know, with a criminal assault record or anything like that. But it's not okay. It's just, there's not a justification for what Will Smith did.
Nick, what would Marlon Brando have done?
Yeah, I think he would have sent Sachin Littlefeather in his place to slap Chris Rock.
You got to outsource.
Can I just say what everybody's thinking is, why couldn't Billy Crystal have been hosting again this year? I'm glad that G.I. Jane 2 is now coming out of turnaround.
Yeah.
Now, it was a bizarre and strange moment. And I think Chris Rock actually, for me, the takeaway, and I, like Catherine, I saw a lot of people, including conservatives, musing about the power of honor culture and, you know, Will Smith, you know, he's in the right here. But to me, the takeaway was just that Chris Rock, who is like a smallish guy, took the smack and didn't even touch his face. Yeah. He was just like, oh, whoa. You know,
that eyebrow. Like the eyebrow is mightier than the sword. It was something.
Will Smith's, you know, little open-faced, open-handed slap.
I think the technical term for what happened there was that he got smacked upside the head. Like, that is the term I was raised with for that action. Like, there's this debate. Is it a smack? Is it a punch? Yeah. He got smacked upside the head.
Yeah.
The act of restraint that was Herculean was, there's a moment you could see it in the John Boy video breakdown, which if you don't follow John Boy.
Very good.
He's incredible. He's the guy who just does sports video recaps, but he's a great lip reader. Single-handedly discovered that the Houston Astros were cheating based on his video reconstructions. Right. But
he would get to the Zapruder film already. America needs to know answers, Matt.
It's about damn time. But anyways, in his video recap, he points out accurately that Chris Rock had a joke. He had a comeback joke, and he did not choose violence in that moment. He chose professionalism because the joke that he would have said, I'm
would
predicting,
have muddied the moral calculus a bit further, maybe.
Denzel would have had to do a lot of peacemaking in that moment if he had done the real joke. There's a lot of material
I think
to work with when it comes to
We definitely learned that Chris Rock is the most, like, should always host the Oscars, is the most professional host you can possibly imagine. We also learned that Denzel Washington is truly a wise man.
Did we learn that?
I think it's also worth pointing out that this is effectively the only thing people will be talking about the Oscars, not just right this week, but for the next 100 years. It really highlights the fact that so many of these kind of legacy media events are just done. Nobody gives a shit. And I think that's a better world.
We also had a brief moment this morning here in the Reason DC office where we explored the was it staged theory, which of course is out there. And, you know, by far the strongest case.
It's not the moon landing.
By far, Hollywood was complicit in that too, Peter.
Stanley Kubrick directed the moon landing. Everyone knows that.
The strongest case for it having been staged was the fact that now some of us, including the people on this podcast, care about the Oscars, and that was otherwise definitely not going to happen. But
I think there's something to be said about the what was the name of the Ted Balaker movie? Can We Take a Joke from like 10 years ago?
Apparently, we cannot.
It's now Can We Take a Slap?
Can We Take a Slap? We cannot, exactly, right? Like the machinery that produces culture or pronounces itself the guardians of produced culture has gotten increasingly unable to take a joke. This is even true, like 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was Ricky Gervais was doing his usual thing, and like Tom Hanks was in the crowd at the Golden Globes, like, that's not okay. Like Tom freaking Hanks, who was in Bosom Buddies, is sitting there and saying, this is not okay to tell jokes like that. It's awful and it's repellent. I don't know if Peter's going to talk about the Oscars later on as a cultural product to have consumed, but I you know, I would flip onto it in the middle of commercials in the Nets game just to say, I should probably pay some attention. And like within 2 seconds, it was so awful to watch. It's literally repellent, the kind of culture that's being put out there.
That's a real end of aristocracy, end of the court. When aristocratic regimes are falling, they become, they're incapable of laughing at themselves or even taking mild critiques, Matt.
And what a damn small man Will Smith is! Holy cow! That's
I think it's worth pointing out that having a conversation about the joke itself was not in any way, shape, or form offensive, and the idea that Jada Pinkett Smith's alopecia, which I know merely by saying that we're all going to be inundated now with online ads for whatever prescription drug.
Because we were using IPNVanish.com.
Yeah, no, we should be using IPNVanish, but VPNVanish, whatever, IPVanish, IPDaily. But it's, the joke was completely inoffensive. And I say that as somebody who saw G.I. Jane.
Yeah. So you're the real victim here.
That's $7
we have been debating in a variety of different facets for several years now, which is, can you make a joking and perhaps even slightly mean-spirited comment that references someone's physical appearance, in particular, something that they are sensitive about? And is that an acceptable thing to do? And that is, in some ways, the sort of the culture war issue that this raises, or at least one of them. And to me, the answer is sometimes it is inappropriate to do that. But it is never, ever, ever acceptable to respond with physical violence.
I think there's just a school of thought where if we have ridden the train all the way down the speeches violence tracks.
I want to see you pull this.
Jump in front of that train.
Is this
now
a trolley problem?
It's a trolley problem. And on one side of the eventually, under that thinking, what Will Smith did is self-defense, right? And I think that is a notion that is underlying many of the people who are kind of sticking up for what he did is, well, if speech is violence, Chris Rock hit him first. Like, that's all.
And well,
I think that's a
wife.
Deeply, I think it's a deeply profound misunderstanding of, the very important bright line that we put between physical violence and speech. But it's also an increasingly common one.
So I would say that is a reasonable way to interpret this. However, dudes have been hitting other dudes for insulting their wives long before anyone knew the term cancel culture.
Right, but
in
that's
fact,
why I said it's the was, horseshoe. That's the horseshoe is like those dudes joining up with the, speech is violence dudes, becoming an unholy alliance of just like Will Smith punching us in the face forever.
Speaking of horseshoes, there was literally a movie called...
That would be
called
almost as bad as having to see Wild Wild West again, in like a 2 minutes hate kind of 1984 thing.
There was literally a movie this year called The Last Duel in which two dudes fought a duel on horses, presumably wearing horseshoes, over the honor of one of their wives, except that the whole point of the movie is that it wasn't about the woman's honor in any real or meaningful way. It was about these two dipshit dudes fighting over their own status.
Sounds right.
All right, let's move on to secondary
Speaking
news,
of
rather.
Dipshit dudes fighting over status?
I was just going to say that if you think that honor culture is all that great, just inspect the cheekbones of the ladies who had to live under it. Anyone who's been around a super macho culture, it's terrible. It is terrible.
And Matt, as a California Angels fan in the 1970s, you know what you're talking about.
Exactly right. All right, let's get to secondary news. President Joe Biden delivered a major address in Warsaw this weekend about Russia's assaults on neighboring Ukraine, during which he made a direct analogy of the Cold War to our current situation, saying, quote, "This battle will not be won in days or months either. We need to steel ourselves of a long fight ahead." Boy, he talks as good as I do. And he also said, "Every generation has had to defeat democracy's moral foes." Biden also announced that the U.S. would be taking in 100,000 Ukrainian refugees. Of the God knows how many there are now, it's in excess of 4 million across the border. He also stated bluntly that Europe must end its dependence on Russian fossil fuels. And in the ad lib heard round the world, added right there at the end, for God's sake, this man cannot remain in power. The White House immediately walked that last bit back. But Catherine, what does that quote unquote gaffe teach us about Biden, about U.S. foreign policy, about lessons learned, not learned, and whatnot?
I think it's the most classic form of the gaffe, right? It is the inadvertent speaking of a truth. It is the inadvertent revelation of your deeply held view.
That's the Kinsley gaffe.
Correct. It is the Kinsley gaffe, which Biden is the highest practitioner of and always has been. So, yeah, I think that Biden, you know, comes from an era and alluded to that era in the speech in which this was somehow something that the U.S. felt that it got to decide. And he still has kind of the muscle memory of that time. And that's what popped out when he ad-libbed. I mean, we, you know, when we watched the State of the Union this year, it was very, very noticeable if you were looking at the prepared speech of the text that each of Biden's stumbles was also him extemporizing.
Including the go get him at the end.
Inexplicable go get him. Who are we going to get? Unclear. Maybe Putin,
say
I guess.
You know, like a shout out to the Texas A&M Aggies.
So I think that there's really this, I think that there really is this, we're not going to fix this problem in Biden. And God knows his advisors, handlers, speechwriters must have all tried. And, you know, this is a thing people legitimately worried about when this man was nominated for the presidency and eventually won it, was that he is going to accidentally start World War III with one of his very, very classic gaffes. Now, this is different than the fear that people had about why Trump might accidentally start World War III, but a legitimate fear nonetheless.
Nick, what is wrong both in terms of an idea and as and in terms of accuracy with the Cold War analogy in this case?
Sorry, Ben, I wasn't really paying attention. I was trying to come up with a Dr. Jill Biden joke that would get me slapped.
Yeah. So
and
Biden
says it's so the Cold I'm going to have to answer. Yeah.
Biden says it's the Cold War. Do you think it's the Cold War?
No,
having lived
it isn't.
Through the Cold War.
Yeah, no. I lived through the Cold War, Matt. I saw it end. I saw that Twilight struggle end, as did you. No, it's not a Cold War because Russia is not the Soviet Union, and this is not a Twilight struggle. And, you know, this is one of the biggest problems with, I think, American foreign policy, certainly, but also, you know, throughout the world. We are constantly inventing monsters to get back to the comfort of the Cold War, which is an insane thought. You know, it's like mutually assured destruction or something. Russia is not going to be marching on Europe. It doesn't mean that they shouldn't face, you know, various kinds of pushback for invading Ukraine, which is, you know, an unspeakable and indefensible act. But to cast this in the Cold War terms, it immediately sets the terms of discussion in the wrong place. We shouldn't be talking about it in those terms.
Peter, this sense of that Catherine was alluding to of you know, regime change is part of our business. One of the things that Biden said was that you know, Russia says that NATO expansion is imperialism, and that couldn't be further from the truth. NATO is a defensive alliance. That's true. That is what NATO is.
Sure. But that's tell not, that to Gaddafi.
But that's
right?
Not only what NATO has done. Is this more evidence of your kind of blob theory of foreign policy in Washington being kind of on autopilot interventionist over the years?
Well, I think if you consider this in terms of the Will Smith slap.
And so we shall.
Thank you, which we must.
No. I think that the problem with Biden's gaffe is that foreign policy should not be conducted this way. This is, like, for one thing, this, and like, Joe Biden should not be off the cuffing American foreign policy, that is the especially American foreign policy with regard to a nuclear power that is already engaged in a war of aggression and is threatening, is saber-rattling to use a vast nuclear arsenal against NATO and U.S. allies already. It's especially a problem that Biden said these particular words, that Putin shouldn't be in power, because Putin is extremely afraid and paranoid about that specific thing. And this is something that, like, Russia watchers have been saying, is that Putin, without, I think he's, like, this is not something that he should be particularly concerned about, though you can understand why a foreign leader who has raised the ire of the United States might be worried, because it is something the United States has done before, is try to engineer regime change. And so he is very particularly worried that the United States is trying to engineer regime change that ends with Vladimir Putin either deposed or dead. And that is going to make him behave in ways that are likely to be worse for the world and for us. And the U.S. just shouldn't be deposing heads of state. Like, regime change as a military and geopolitical policy goal is a very bad idea, and U.S. presidents shouldn't be talking that way. That said, I do think that if we step back just a little bit and we could, like, if we could take off the table all of the geopolitical concerns and the fact that it is, in fact, it's a terrible idea to go and try and change other countries' governments and think that that's our business, it would be better if Vladimir Putin were not in charge of Russia. If there were, like, somebody who was, you know, democratic and reasonable and wasn't out to invade Ukraine and kill a lot of people and threaten to use nuclear weapons. Like, that would, in
we
fact,
don't know
be better,
that.
Right?
Right? We don't know
so,
that. We don't know
so
what's going to happen.
It's certainly possible
I
don't mean that the person who would end up in charge if Vladimir Putin died tonight would be better. I mean that it would be better if Putin weren't in charge and someone who was better was in charge.
Better things are better.
You're starting to sound uncannily like Kamala Harris right now, which I just want to bring up.
But this is why you don't take...
Can we give Harris to the Soviets, to the Russians?
This is why you don't try to engineer regime change, is because it's always chaotic and you don't know how it's going to go. And if, you know, like, if the U.S. did something very direct, like assassinated Vladimir Putin, which is obviously not something that we're planning on doing. But if we tried to do something like that, who would end up in charge? We don't even know. And it's not at all obvious that the next guy in line, or the guy who would end up in charge after a power struggle, would be any good either. And this is, again, one of the reasons why U.S. presidents shouldn't ever be talking this way, and why foreign policy in particular should not be conducted via off-the-cuff moralism.
Dolph Lundgren would be in
charge. It does make me worry about Biden, you know, because he really does not seem to be, you know, fully in control of himself. And I think, you know, that was a serious concern during the election. You know, it's not like we had a better choice necessarily. We had, you know, a kind of equally or awful in different ways choice. But this kind of stuff is disturbing, and it reminded me that Obama, you know, kind of ad-libbed us into Syria, and Biden, you know, was the vice president then. Like, he doesn't have a good track record, you know, in the past 20 years, say.
Well, people were correctly upset at President Trump shooting from the hip and saying crazy things on a regular basis, and this is just a reminder that it's not strictly a Trump problem, nor strictly a Republican problem.
To be clear, buying Greenland, not crazy. We can all agree on that. Catherine, 100,000 refugees from Ukraine, too little, too much, Goldilocks, just the right amount?
I mean, I always and forever think that choosing a number artificially is a weird and wrong way to go about this process. You know, we might, for instance, just vet everyone who applies for eligibility, and then if they're eligible, let them in, and then that would be the number that we let them in, and our eligibility standards should be easy to meet and clear. But 100,000 is certainly better than zero. I have seen some coverage already of the fact that similar to our promises to our Afghan allies, friends, supporters, etc., that this promise does not yet have a really meaningful bureaucratic push behind it, and that people are going to wind up caught in limbo, just as many, many Afghans did. So I'm worried about that. I think, you know, our entire immigration system, but especially our treatment of asylum seekers and refugees, is so broken. It's by design. It has been, you know, slowed spectacularly. And you can't just snap your fingers and fix that. You can't just sort of make it possible to process 100,000 applications, or in fact, many, many more applications for 100,000 spots. We're not going to be good at that. I do hope, it is my profound hope, that most of the folks who left Ukraine are staying in Europe and staying in the region because they're going to go home. I mean, these people who have left have, I think at this point, still a reasonable expectation that most of them will be able to go home. Now, what there is to go home to is another question, but they will go back to the place which they call their home and rebuild it. But I certainly wouldn't blame Ukrainians who were like, you know what? I'm out. I'm done here. I'm off to go where the streets are paved with cheese, and we should welcome them.
I was talking with some people yesterday who are involved in getting Afghans out of Afghanistan, and they were saying that not only has the kind of machinery stopped moving in terms of Ukrainians, but it's also, it's taken all of the energy away from doing anything with Afghans in U.S. government channels, so that it's not only are Ukrainians not being handled particularly well by U.S. The U.S. State Department and whatnot, but it's, you know, now nobody's talking about Afghans, which just adds to the tragedy of this.
For those interested in the topic, stay tuned to Reason.com, because John Stossel is going to have a video on this featuring one of the four of us talking about this very topic. And you're going to have to figure who that out is later. Okay, let's get to our listener email of the week in a moment. But first, think even your gold-plated health insurance plan covers all the costs associated with a medical emergency? Think again. Health insurance typically does not cover the full amount of an emergency medical flight. That's where AirMed Care Network comes in. When you become a member of AirMed Care, if an emergency should arise, you will not see a bill for air medical transport when flown by an AMCN provider. This peace of mind can cover your entire household, beginning at the low, low price of $85 a year. AMCN providers transport more than 100,000 patients a year. Listeners to the Roundtable get, with their membership, a gift card from Visa or Amazon worth up to $50. Just visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason and use offer code REASON and start protecting your family pronto. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, email your queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Brenner Roth. That's a great name, if it's in fact real. Who writes, do you think the U.S. has moved from a society of tolerance to one of forced acceptance? And based on your answer, do you think that's a positive or a negative? It seems to me that major culture war issues bubble up when they are forced upon adults or involve children. For instance, no one really cared about drag queens until drag queen story hours. Speak for yourself, pal. No one really cared about the trans movement until the bathroom bills and sports issues. Many more examples could be named, I'm sure. Love the show. Thanks for everything you do. Thank you, Brenner. Catherine?
My answers to the two questions are yes, and it is negative, but I want to put a little asterisk on my yes, which is that I think those of us who are troubled by what I think is pretty appropriately dubbed here the forced acceptance trend, we can sometimes be guilty of a little bit of golden ageism about some kind of highly tolerant era that existed. I don't know when it was supposed to have existed. Maybe, I guess, like the late 90s for a second, but also, not even then, because like being called gay on the playground was still an insult. So I guess I would just say, like, our definition of a sort of tolerant society has rightly expanded, and that, you know, we accepted certain kinds of certain kinds of, you know, mistreatment of other people and mischaracterization of people with different demographics or whatever. So that was not a fully tolerant society. We have never experienced a fully tolerant society, either in the kind of colloquial sense that we use it now, or in the kind of deep liberal sense of kind of pluralism and toleration. However, we skipped right from, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we were cool to each other, to it, being cool to each other is mandatory and will be punished with a fine and or jail time. And that is not great.
Nick, what say you?
I don't think that we live in an era of forced acceptance and toleration. You know, there's a couple of cases, you know, the masterpiece cake shop in Colorado and things like that. But by and large, people are still very free to air whatever their opinions are. And they do it with great frequency, especially after they have a lot of drinks and things like that. And I find that this kind of question often is just kind of a way of trying to frame a conversation. So it's like, well, you know, we don't care about drag queens, but then they're in our public libraries. It's okay if they're in our, you know, if they're in private brunch spots in DuPont Circle or something, but why do they have to be here, there, or anywhere? And I just don't see that happening very much. There's, you know, cultural changes, but certain types of businesses feel a need to parade around how tolerant they are by, you know, having a Benetton ad of all sorts of people and, you know, and everything, are doing, land acknowledgements and things like that. But you're always free to leave or to roll your eyes in like 99% of those options, situations.
I mean, if the DEI, the diversity, equity, and inclusion human resources person comes into your workplace and starts saying, you know, you're either a racist or an anti-racist, and you're sitting around a group of 20 people, are you free to say anything in that moment? I kind of question. I mean, thankfully, so far, we haven't had many of those at Reason Foundation, but that's an increasingly common scenario.
You can say something. No, I'm just saying this, and this letter reminded me of in the 90s, I wrote a lot about kind of political correctness on campuses, and conservative scholars would routinely say that they were not being taken seriously, or that everywhere they looked on campus, you know, there was just all this left-wing bullshit. And it's like, it's true, you know, and you know, there are times when it becomes a, you know, a kind of rarely a law per se, but it becomes like it has the effect of that. But it's like you have to speak up. And it's like, yeah, there are more DEI workshops than there were 20 years ago. But it's also like, for the most part, people can still register dissent, and they do. That's the point. I mean, there's like large swaths of America where you're not going to hear anybody saying, no, you know, drag queen story hour is actually a good idea.
Peter, maybe a way of looking at this is some of this a case where the kind of Twitter bubble mores are coming into normie land and people are like, what the hell's going on around here?
Yeah, I think there's some of that. And I would just second Catherine's historical perspective here. I think tolerance and forced acceptance have always coexisted and fought for control of the culture in the United States. Children have always been a proxy for adult culture war issues, or at least sort of in the modern era they have, since children are understood as uniquely defenseless. And the reality is that true tolerance is really pretty rare and always has been. Most people are and always have been for tolerance, but only within a specific band of opinions centered around their own opinion. And that's not really tolerance. True tolerance is hard because it means accepting in some way views that you find repugnant, deeply repugnant and awful. It means accepting views that you think shouldn't be part of the discourse. But that's what you have to do, and you have to find a way to allow those views to exist. That's what tolerance is. And most people don't do that, don't want to do that, and don't think you should have to do that. And we're just seeing different and new expressions of that, of resistance to that idea.
I have a eternal an axiom or theory of defense when it comes to this. I remember, I think I was participating in a commentary magazine symposium after the 2008 election, right? So Obama wins, McCain loses. Now we have a Democrat in the White House. What does it mean for conservatism going forward? You know, what advice might you have?
That you must have had a lot to say about that, Matt, because you're both a liberal and a conservative, right?
Yes, a liberal
and a
leading
big
conservative
commentary
liberal.
Reader magazine, right?
I like commentary. Anyways, yes, I think my first sentence was like, why the hell are you asking me anything about this question?
Or did you riff off of Norman Podhoretz, probably the most famous commentary magazine article of all time, and title your answer my new Negro problem and ours?
I remember more the World War IV article. It's more my era. A lot of great articles in that vein in 2002 and 2003. Y'all should just like look up anytime Max Boot wrote a cover story, just like roll around in it, smear it on your chest hair. So my counsel then, because this has already been forgotten by the political memory machine, but there was the Terry Schiavo case. Nick Gillespie. And I don't ask me the details. I'll get all of it wrong.
You know, I like the main to thing think to remember, we're just being dreamed by Terry Schiavo.
The main thing to remember is that it happened in Florida, the source of all true culture war. Like, that's like that's where the culture war, like the neutrons are like smashed against each other into
the breadbasket of the culture war, where the genetic diversity for culture wars exists.
Where the line between brain dead and brain alive is as murky as the Everglades.
As murky as Buck Sexton's milk.
Buck Sexton complained. Yeah, Buck Sexton, was like happy that in North Florida, where I grew up, when you ask for milk, you get milk. Not a question about what kind
you
of milk
you
would like.
Milk. You get cow's milk. None of that milk. Nut milk. None of that homosexual nut milk.
Guys, oat milk is great. It's so good.
I know. This is the thing. Like, I'm betting you, Buck Sexton, is like, why when I go into a supermarket do I need to be assaulted by nut milks?
Tried to start a nuclear war.
Like, we talked about that.
Yeah, but let's talk about the nut milk some more.
Anyways, my only prayer for my conservative friends was, stop playing offense, play defense. Defense is attractive inherently. If people are coming into voters' grills, into their kitchens, and telling them what to do, then they're going like, what the hell? There was a sense in the Terry Schiavo case that Republicans were jumping into other people's affairs in a way that struck people as odd. And there was a reaction against that, and that there will be plenty of opportunities where the kind of newly dominant people on the left in various spheres are going to overreach and force something on people, not just like force coexistence, but force you to accept something. And in those cases, play defense and it'll be popular. And I think there's something to that. And there's also something to people who win a long game argument to be magnanimous and not to get out the Will Smith right hand and start slapping people in the face. All right.
Can I, just to prolong this torture, we're talking Terry Schiavo. I mean, let's live Terry Schiavo for a second. Peter, is it really that hard? Do you really believe it's that hard to be tolerant? Or are you assuming that's for other people? I'm just curious, because, like, you know, we always say that, but it's like, I don't think it's that hard to not really be bothered by other people living lives that you find kind of stupid or repellent.
I think it's self-evidently difficult for many people, and that is why we have the arguments that we have, is because so many of our arguments that are not about economic policy or whether Biden should gaff us into nuclear war, the arguments that animate people and that make up the culture war, the things that people just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk about all the time, are almost always, what kind of lifestyles should we allow, and what kind of lifestyles should we disfavor or attempt to even prohibit or disencourage with policy, right?
But I think it's small numbers are that that are staging those conversations.
But
right?
I think
like,
those.
Who really
but I think,
cared that Target no, let trans people choose
actually,
their dressing.
This country
room.
Used to have miscegenation laws. Yeah. Like I don't know what do you mean? Is it hard? Like all no, of human history is the story of people struggling horribly
about,
against those impulses.
Yeah, what I'm talking about is now, like you know, when we're talking about culture war issues and with trans things, like it was very few people who really cared that Target was going to let trans people choose their dressing rooms.
Now, the question, Nick, the question is the parents of 54 million school kids, because that's where it comes up. It comes up where, you know, at the activism unit that they had at my oldest daughter's fourth grade class, they were all very heavily encouraged by the teachers to do some kind of activism thing. And one of them, under a teacher encouragement, was to do an anti-gun demonstration rally. Okay, whatever, fine. I don't care. And another one, the kids spontaneously decided that what the most important thing for fourth graders who are nine to do was to petition the school for a gender-neutral bathroom. At an age where I don't think any of them know what gender is at all. And so you're and, you know, particularly in cities like Brooklyn, which is a real city. But elsewhere, too, you're going to get confronted with these choices and these value decisions there. And as mentioned before, in the human resources departments. But I am putting a button on this done because Catherine is the boss. And we had a constitutional confirmation Supreme Court hearing last week. We need to talk about it. Ketanji Brown Jackson, KBJ, was up 3 days or so last week. I'm sure all of us watched all of the gavel-to-gavel coverage. At issue was apparently child porn and dark money and people touching Cory Booker and apparently whether Republicans believe that you should have defense attorneys in the United States of America. So let's go around and the table here, Catherine, starting with you, and pull out a highlight, low light from the hearing and what one thinks about KBJ.
I found myself in the discourse around her record actually becoming a little more positive on her over time. I already had the bug put in my ear by Reason's Damon Root that she had some pretty good decisions in her past, including Patterson v. United States, which is about a protester cursing at Occupy protesters, maybe just a counter protester cursing at Occupy protesters, getting arrested for that, and that Jackson basically laughed that out of court, just absolutely denied qualified immunity protections to the officer that did the arrest and just like scoffed at them. Love that. Love the energy. The Gitmo stuff, the idea that somehow it's like an indictment on this woman's character that she did the thing that our adversarial judicial system demands, which is represent, offer representation to both sides. Absolutely be clowning themselves to suggest otherwise. I think that she had a nice little moment where John Cornyn said something about basically the Supreme Court thwarting the will of the majority when it struck down some regulations. And Jackson, just like really smooth, was like, well, Senator, that is the nature of a right. When there is a right, it means there are limitations on regulation. So like, yes, will she do things I hate? For sure, she will be a Supreme Court justice. But I like that. I like some of the energy she was bringing in the hearing, and always watching these things is a reminder that the Senate is foul. It is just a bunch of grandstanding douchebags, and even grandstanding kindness, I guess, in the form of the Cory Booker move, still gross. Stop. We could just skip all that. Thank you.
Super gross. Peter, you live in Washington. What were the hearings like for you?
So I mostly consumed them through Reason's coverage. But the thing that stood out to me is just something that, falls in line with some of what we've been talking about on this episode, which is the kind of culture war above all nature of it, the just obsession with child porn, and in particular, Josh Hawley's attacks on Jackson, which Jacob Solem, among others, wrote about, I think, quite well. So Hawley argued that Jackson, as a federal judge, showed an alarming pattern of sentencing leniency for sex criminals who are preying on children. Right. And so this is using children as fodder for really a baseless and crappy culture war attack on Jackson that is just designed to get Hawley attention, designed to get him on Fox News, designed to play to his base of, you know, sort of middle American voters who, for whatever reason, Missouri voters have always had, like, this is always like Missouri has always been a bastion of senators who play up this sort of thing, right? So there's always a, like, the internet's coming for our children. The sex trafficking is really, really bad in St. Louis. That, like, it's just sort of an odd artifact of political geography that I don't fully understand. But, you know, Hawley's attack suggests sexual harm to children, which is both horrific and prurient and therefore designed to get people to say, oh, my goodness, right? And it's also a not-so-subtle nod to QAnon paranoia about the sex cabal led by liberal elites that is organizing mass campaigns of child rape. And it just also, and it completely misunderstands the law and the cases, many of which are about teenagers. And so Andy McCarthy, a former prosecutor who writes for National Review, wrote a really good piece about this and why Hawley's attacks were just deceptive and malicious is because in many, many cases, the people who end up being prosecuted and charged with child porn have just turned 18 or are 19 years old, are not, you know, the sort of the stereotype of these dirty old male predators, but in fact themselves are teenagers. And it's he talked about just sort of about the way that minimum sentence guidelines end up putting these kids in jail for very long periods of time, just ruining their lives for deep mistakes and for things that, you know, perhaps, like, he didn't say that he thought that the possession of child pornography should be legal, but he said the sentencing guidelines are a real problem, and they don't actually help with the underlying issue in any way. And so, it is Hawley's attacks, which just took over the hearings, were based on a misunderstanding. I think probably a purposeful misunderstanding of the law. And they were just designed to get Josh Hawley attention and to make everyone focus on this, on a narrow issue that seems like it's really a horrific and prurient thing when it's something completely different. And in conclusion, Catherine's right, the Senate's awful.
Nick, you like the Senate. What was the highlight?
Yeah, they're my favorite. I made me think I'm missing the Washington Steps, you know, who are the ultimate
Capital.
Victim.
Capital steps.
Capital steps. Excuse me. Yeah, the Washington steps. Capital steps. But, you know, we Capital won't see their team. Like again, Matt. We'll That's search true. The horizon in vain for somebody who can replace them. But I think this hearing was actually pretty good because it is Josh Hawley showed that he is a fucking douchebag. So he belongs in the Senate, clearly by Catherine's criteria, which I agree with. The one moment, what I liked about this, and there were a couple of libertarians like Randy Barnett, who was actually, who is oftentimes very partisan. I interviewed him when Mitch McConnell was screwing over Merrick Garland. And because Randy, although he's a very libertarian, you know, thinker, he sides with the Republicans operationally, pragmatically. He was kind of into that idea of, like, you know, not giving Obama a Supreme Court nomination through a kind of, you know, technically legal but kind of sketchy strategy. But he was like, you know what, she's actually pretty good on a lot of stuff like that. I mean, it was good to see libertarians saying, you know what, she's actually pretty good on stuff. And, you know, I think this was harder to turn into a partisan circus despite Hawley and other people's best attempts. So she seems okay. The one moment, and I didn't follow it this closely, I don't know if you guys have more to say about it, that one moment where Marsha Blackburn, who is really not, you know, dragging the IQ, the average IQ of the Senate up, you know, towards three digits to begin with, but she stumped her with the question of, she asked her something about like trans rights, and the nominee said, I'm not a biologist, so I can't answer like who is a woman.
Yeah, to define a woman. That was the
yeah, question. And yeah. You know, that struck me as a you know, as a weak moment.
I have to say, I read that somewhat sympathetically as her just figuring out a way to say fuck off with this without saying the words fuck off with this in a Senate confirmation hearing. Like, I don't think that was like her expressing a radical skepticism about the notion of womanness, you know. I don't want to do this. I'm not going to do this.
But then she should have said, yeah, but I mean, it's like, what, you're there, you know? And it's like, she could have said, you know, whatever the, you know, the individual identifies as, if that's what she believes, or she could have unveiled some novel, you know, three-pronged test
many, many
to see what is a woman.
In America are still trying to sort some of that out. And she was like, let me not ruin my own life and potentially the lives of many other people by blurting out some dumb stuff
I would have loved to have heard that.
Your job,
I think it was
Matt. What did you think? Are you happy that she's going to be, you know, running your life now when she joins, you know, a group that may be even more idiotic than the Senate, you know, the Supreme Court?
I am glad that there is a diversity of having a defense lawyer on the Supreme Court and someone who's had some. No, I'm serious. The criminal justice system is so overweighted everywhere and always with prosecutors and with people who come from that part of the justice system. And it's nice to see something else, so people who will have some built-in experience with arguments that express skepticism about the power of the state. I got nothing wrong with that as a basic concept. And I think it'll be interesting to see you know, how she matches up with Neil Gorsuch, for example, on some of those questions. He's more regulatory, but he's also shown some interest in criminal justice issues using skepticism.
Well, that might be, you know, I think there's a slow-moving realignment going on, which we are obviously always preaching in various ways, but there does seem to be, you know, at the Supreme Court, an increasing skepticism of state power in all of its manifestations, and it's slowly oozing in. And hopefully, you know, that's reflecting something that's happening in the country as well.
Speaking of slow ooze, let's get to our end of show, what you have been consuming in the cultural arena. Peter, do you want to launch us?
I watched the Oscars, and I've already forgotten who won which movie won Best Picture.
It was the Led Zeppelin
Coda.
Record, I think.
It was Coda.
Or Romeo and Juliet. Was that in the running this year?
Nick's really going for the deep cuts here with the Capitol Steps and the Romeos. Mm. Okay.
Was Coda perfectly, even a little bit delightful, but not... This is a movie about a child of... deaf parents and a deaf sibling, and the deaf family works but the child is herself not deaf, and so she dreams of being a singer. Her family runs a fishing boat, and you know, sort of ends up with some complications there. There is a great little regulatory angle in the movie because there is a subplot about a new law that has been put in place that makes it very difficult for small fishermen to do business, because it requires state oversight, and it hits the small fishing boats hardest. And I think laws that are like nominally intended to make fishing and sort of some of these practices safer actually impose real serious costs.
Go figure.
Is a sub point that the movie makes without very straightforwardly and in a smart way. But the movie itself is a little bit too earnest for my taste, and a little bit sort of a little bit too formulaic. It has real sort of Mr. Holland's Opus vibes. And as a former band kid, I watched that movie so many times. Anytime there was a substitute in band class, like the substitute is not going to be able to teach you how to play the tuba. So the substitute is going to put on Mr. Holland's Opus, and you are going to watch 49 minutes of it while talking to your friends. So I saw 49 minutes of that movie like dozens and dozens of times. And I didn't love it even the first time I saw it, and I especially didn't love it the 14th time I saw minutes 1 through 49. And Coda is maybe a little bit better than that, but it still has that same, like, really? They have a dream of playing music and, like, finding that. It's just, and it's good. It's well made. It's, like, I can't hate that movie, but I think
is there a moment when the singer, like, puts the deaf parents' ears on their chest or something so they can finally hear?
There must be. There has to be. Or like a speaker, like they lean to, they feel the vibrations on the speaker.
At the very end, the parents look around and see people clapping and understand, but it's hard for them because they can't hear their child sing, and so there's a disconnect.
Yeah. Oh, it's
really hard when your parents don't understand you is the theme of all movies, I think.
Yeah,
Catherine, what were you doing when you were not watching? I'm cutting you off, Peter.
Thank you. Thank you.
First of all, Drumline is superior to Mr. Holland's Opus in all ways, but I was not watching the Oscars because I respect myself. And so what I did instead was the last few weeks, for various reasons, I've been maybe like leaning a little bit too hard into escapist literature. And so I've read just like a lot of books with dragons in them. And I want to recommend to you the best of the various dragon books I've been reading, which this one is called The Priory of the Orange Tree. And it's by Samantha Shannon. And don't scoff, Gillespie. People like dragons. And I like dragons too. This book,
I thought you were
is
becoming more realist this time. That's why I was laughing.
And it's very good. It's very, very long, which, again, if your business is escapism, is a recommendation. And it has like a nice lesbian subplot for people who are interested in that sort of thing. But mostly it has like very solid dragon geopolitics, which the last time I recommended a dragon book on this podcast, it was a similar case. I like it when the author tries to figure out what war with dragons would look like. And this one did a good job. So The Priory of the Orange Tree for your escapist needs.
Are any of the dragons deaf?
None of the dragons are deaf. You know, the
are they lesbian?
Dragons,
are they the lesbians?
Don't seem to have sexualities. The Associated Press issued some guidelines on how to correctly style the word deaf last week, and I'm now wondering if it was in anticipation of the Oscars. For those who are interested, deaf lowercase to describe people, deaf uppercase if you're describing the deaf community. So just sit with that.
I now hate style books. Nick.
Oh, now? Now?
Speaking of hate, Nick, what did you consume?
I watched the new Amy Schumer show on Hulu. It's called Life and Beth. And it's a very high-minded and ambitious undertaking because it seeks to recast Long Island, which is, you know, the cloaca of America, into a place that people would want to live. So it's, you know, and it mostly gets that job done. I highly recommend it. It's funny, it's sad, it's incredibly dark at times, and it's also totally enjoyable. It's there's like 10 episodes, about half an hour a piece. I watched it 5 hours straight while tripping for part of that too. So it's like, you know, this,
so you
this
have no
holds
idea whether
one's
or not
attention.
It was good, actually.
That's what I'm saying.
So Catherine wasn't the only one riding the dragon.
Yeah, that's right. I don't ride the dragon. I chase the dragon.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a difference.
Okay.
But it's very good. It's like I said, it's funny, it's dark, and it shows, Amy Schumer, I thought was fantastic. You know, the Amy Schumer show, which was not that long ago, but it seems like in a different world, was so great. And then she had a couple of, you know, good comedy specials. The movie Trainwreck was massively popular, and was pretty good. But this is a really good show. It makes me interested to see a second season and also what she's going to be up to next. And because it's, you know, I think a lot of people dislike her work-based statements when she mouths off about stuff. This is really good stuff.
Amy Schumer. Is better. That's like the triangle better sign.
Greater than.
Greater than. Chuck Schumer.
Mm-hmm.
True. If we must choose a Schumer, the choice is clear.
The yeah. best Schumer.
Yeah, yeah. She's the better Schumer.
Schumer? Chuck so Schumer. I
Chuck Schumer, Matt Welch.
I the drummer from the Foo Fighters or Foo Fighters yeah. without the die, Taylor Hawkins, who mm-hmm. I'm not a huge Foo Fighters fan, but always appreciated their kind of good humor, and especially his, because he's the drummer in the band where Dave Grohl is the lead singer. Dave Grohl is one of the world's best drummers for Nirvana, and also played drums in the first couple of Foo Fighters records. Sweet dude, by all accounts, know people who knew him. He died in a hotel room in Colombia on Friday, and one can presume heart problems exacerbated by lifestyle, I'm sure. And so it was very sad moment. Nice guy. He's a pretty good singer. You can see clips of him online singing like Somebody to Love and other Queen songs at Foo Fighters shows and doing kind of a decent job. And I was hipped to that he's made 3 solo records, Taylor Hawkins and the Coattail Riders, 3 records over the last 15 or so years. And I listened to 2 of them because the first one's not easy to find on streaming devices. The second one I would recommend really highly, called Red Light Fever from 2010, Taylor Hawkins, the Coattail Riders. Dude just loved Queen. That's what he loved. Like, all the Foo Fighters stuff is him singing Queen songs. On Red Light Fever, he has 2 different songs where Brian May, the lead guitarist for Queen, is playing. The drummer, who's his hero, whatever his name is, Roger Taylor, sings on the record in places. It's just like really exuberant power pop rock with a little Gen X sadness thrown in. Really good. I like it better than Foo Fighters, which isn't that hard of a lift for me, but it's very sad. A really super gifted musician, by all accounts, just like a great, great dude who's Dave Grohl's best friend. It's very sad that he died. Honor his life, if you're so inclined, by listening to his music, including Nick Gillespie. He sang or added vocals to a version of a Dennis Wilson solo record, the Pacific Ocean Blue, whatever the thing that's called. And it's a really great great song that you can find there on the streaming device. So R.I.P. Taylor.
Drummers are the most tragic figures in rock and roll, Matt Welch.
That's right. Besides those of us who survive. And on that note, listen to all of our stuff, reason.com/podcasts, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum debate series, curated by Gene Epstein. And if you like our business as a business, please support it by going to reason.com/donate. That's it, and we'll see you next week.